Now then, what we want to see then is this. To understand one thing. Now here's important. If you understand one point, it's worth your time. You cannot say anything that will comfort them. There's nothing you can say that will comfort a griever. So just write that down. I don't care how smart you are. I don't care how much education you've got. You can't say anything that will comfort them and get them out of shock. Not one thing. It's an impossibility. And the interesting thing is, are you ready for this? The interesting thing is, the griever knows it's impossible and doesn't expect you to. That's the interesting thing. As you come up to me and you try to say, Lowell, I love you, whatever you say, what you're wanting to do is to cure my problems, take my pain away. And there's nobody that knows better than I. Nothing you can say will take my pain away. I was just as smart after she died as I was before. And when after she died, I knew everything that I knew before. And before she died, I knew I was a man that had never gone through grief, and I was a man that did not know how to talk to a griever. And when you came up and talked to me, I knew you didn't know what to say to me. And there's not a person there that knew it more than I knew. And yet, the people didn't know I knew it. See? And so, you're wanting to do it, and you're wanting to slip away. So let's face it, when you go up to a griever, that griever is as smart as you, that person knows there's nothing you can say, that person does not expect you to say anything that's going to take the pain away. And if you can just understand that one point, it'll help so much. So you say, what do you say? Okay, here's some things. Whatever you say, make it general. Let them know that you hurt. Now you say, general, what do you mean? Go up and put your hand on their shoulders and just say, I'm so sorry. That's all. And then look at them and let them talk. Or walk up, and here's a better one, and say, you must hurt so badly. Don't come up and say, I know how you hurt, but just come up and say, you must hurt so badly. That's a very comforting statement. Because then, I know you've got some concept of what, yeah, I hurt worse than I've ever hurt in all my life. I've hurt so bad that I can't explain it. And now I understand that you understand a little bit. See? You're not trying to say some silly thing that takes my pain away that can't be done. You understand. I like that. Another one that's even better is to say, I can't imagine how badly you hurt. That's touching. Now, I'm serious with all of this. And you know the reason why that's touching? It's because if you've never lost a mate and you come up and you say, I can't imagine how you hurt. I know you're smart. You just spoke the truth. You can't imagine how I hurt. You said something sensible. And I'll listen to you if you want to say anything else. It's very comforting to do that. You can just come up, I'm so shocked. I can't imagine. Be general. Don't go up and tell a person what they have to do. Just be general. Go up and just tell them, I don't know. I just can't imagine what you're there. And let them understand that you're in pain. And that's the person that comforts the other person. Isn't that simple? And what you have to do is just understand that that person, the griever, understands the situation a million times better than you do. Because that really is the truth. Now, it's not the words you speak. It's the actions. Go and be there. That's the important thing. It's your presence. You know, that night there's about 30 or 40 people just flooded into that hospital. I only remember one word that was spoken, one thing that somebody said to me. There was one lady that came in and she said, Lowell, she said, you have been our example for the past 25 years. And she said, I know you'll show us how to go through this also. That's the sum total of all the words that I know that was spoken in the hospital that night. Now, whether anybody said anything else, I don't know. But I do know, sitting there and looking around at about 30 or 40 faces that were just looking at me. That's all they were doing, just looking. And they were white. Nobody's saying anything. And I can't tell you the comfort that I got from those people. Had they been there giving me advice, I'd have gotten up and run because I couldn't have taken it. But since they were there, they had driven all that period of time. I was overwhelmed. And I knew that they loved me, and I knew that they wanted to help me, and I knew they couldn't help me, and I knew they knew that they couldn't help me. But I knew that people who know that they can't help me and still come to try to help me are people that can help me. Now, if you didn't follow that one, get the tapes. Because that makes sense again. That's how a griever really feels. So just stand there and stare. That helps. Just sit and shake your head. Those are the kind of people that you appreciate. Because you know they hurt. And you know that. I had a man and a woman to come by my office one day and say, come and go with us. We want to go eat. So I went out and bought a soup with him. He said, I want to go out and take a picture. So we went out and took a picture of the house. And then he turned and went drove up to Snoqualmie Falls and said, let's go and get a cup of coffee. And we just sat there all afternoon. I just talked. And all he and his wife did was just shake their head. That's all they did. I don't remember one word they did. I'll never forget that day. Never in all my life will I ever forget that day. And one of the most comforting days that I had. The two people came by and took me out for a cup of coffee and let me talk for 3 to 4 straight hours. And they never said, I understand. They just shook their head. And they'd throw out their handkerchief and they'd wipe the tears as they cried with me. I can't tell you what it meant to me. Be there. Now, when you do talk, talk about the dead person. This is so important. When you do talk to a griever, talk about the dead person and the griever. Now, this is my mistake. Just a few years ago with my mother, my sister died. I would go and I was back there and we buried my sister and then we'd go home and mom would be running around and I wouldn't talk about my sister. I thought, well, maybe mom's making the bed. Maybe her mind's off of her now. And so I wouldn't bring up my sister. Little did I know that every moment my sister was on my mom's mind. And that's the reason I really never had any bitter feelings when somebody did some of these things to me, because I've done them to everybody else. I know how people think because I think like people. I am a people, see? And so we understand how people think. Talk about that person. You say, you just go in and talk about the dead? Yes, yes. That's all I want to talk about. I don't care about your house. I don't care about your job. I don't care about anything. At that particular time, if you're going to have your leg amputated, I didn't care. I mean, I had so many problems, I didn't care. The only one thing I cared about, my wife is dead. And that's what I want to talk about. And anybody that tried to divert my mind off of that just was irritating. And this is true with everybody. Now listen to what this person says. Here it is that they interviewed a person. A widower expressed his sense of abandonment in this way. Everyone meant well. They came to see me. The women kissed me on the cheek and whispered, I'm so sorry. The men shook my hand and said, if there's anything I can do to help, just let me know. And then they sat around talking about the weather and even politics. They talked around me and at me, but not with me. It was a nightmare. So the interviewer said, well, what did you want these people to do? He said, stop pretending it was a social call. My wife was killed in an automobile accident. I wanted to talk about her. If they had sat next to me long enough to listen, I would have talked about it. That's how they'd know. And that's true. Don't go talk about something else. And you say, but isn't it terrible to talk about the dead? No. That's what the person wants to talk about. Go in and talk about them. If you want to tonight, come up to me and say, Lowell, I remember a time when Doris, and you'll catch my attention. Yeah? And I'm willing to listen. See? I wanted to talk about it. And so talk about her. Go out for coffee. And when you go out for coffee after church on Sunday night, sit down and talk about the dead. Say, how you doing? Give them a chance to talk. How you feeling? How you getting along? See? Talk about them like that. I never forget a couple phone calls that were made. One was made by Ben Clutterball the time I think I was coming down to Portland or something, and after she had been dead, and he called and he said, Lowell, would you like for me to come to Portland and stay in the motel with you up there so you don't have to be with yourself the first night? I really appreciated that. The other was from Al Craig. Al called me and he said, how you doing? And most people, when they would call, they sometimes they'd say, I'm sorry about your wife, but they'd talk about other things. Well, I want to talk to you about this, and then maybe I'm sorry about your wife. Well, thank you, and hang up. And I'll call and said, how you doing? How you feeling? I talked to him. I wanted to talk to him. I feel rotten. That's what I told him. I feel terrible. And I said, he said, I just don't see how you go through certain things. I remember the question he asked me. It's a question that's on your mind. He said, Law said, I don't see how you can go to bed without her. How do you go to bed without her being on that other side? He said, I just can't imagine if my wife died ever being able to go to bed with her on that other side. That's not a stupid question to me, because I've thought about that all my life. That's the last thing I could do is ever go in there to that bedroom. But do you know the truth? And what I told Alice, I said, Alice, not hard at all. Going to bed. I said, that's what I thought too. I said, I want to tell you really what happens. You're in so much pain and agony every minute of the day, from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed. Whatever you do doesn't increase the pain. It's kind of like if somebody had a hold of your arm, twisting your arm until it was just about to break off, and the agony is so great that you feel that you can't take it anymore, and every once in a while they loosen up and then rip it again, and all day long. And you go to bed, and that same big fella's got your arm, and he's twisting it, and you crawl in bed, there's no difference in the pain. Now, you wouldn't know that unless you've been through it. The things you fear the most don't happen. And that would be a comforting feeling for you folks, because every man in here has thought about that particular thing. So talk about it. Call and talk about the dead person. Talk about it when you're around them. See, talk about it then. Don't think that they forget it. If you see me next year, don't feel badly to say, Lowell, how you doing with your grief? Now, what you think is, you think, well, I'll bet Lowell hadn't thought about Doris for a long time, and if I bring up her name, it'll cause a lot of heartache, so I won't talk about Doris, you see. No. See, that's what you're thinking about anyway. And so, no, it won't hurt you. So talk about the dead. Talk to the person and let the person do the talking and you do the listening. See, listen. Listen, listen, listen. That's the key. It's not what you say, it's what you don't say. If you will be the listener and let the person talk and ask the question and keep them talking, you will be solving that problem. I can't emphasize that over enough. Now, what needs to be done? Saying, if you go in and saying, call me if you need anything, it's the same as saying, I don't want to do anything for you, but I want you to think that I'd like to. I don't want to do it, but I want to get the credit for doing it. That really is what it is. I think if you'll be honest, you'll know that's kind of what you got in your mind. See, when you say that. Look around, do whatever needs to be done. Now, let me suggest some things that you do. After you talk with them, go and talk with them. Every time you see them, ask them how they're doing and talk about the dead person. Send a card. Now, I know many of you in this audience sent me a card. I know where you got that card. Same place I get them. You're driving down the street and you said, you know, I need to get Lowell a car. I can just tell it like it is, see. I never lost my senses. You said, I need to get Lowell a car, but I don't have time now. Supper's ready. And some of you went home. You didn't stop and get me a car. You didn't go out of your way long enough to stop and get me a car. You said, what made you so smart? Because I've done that. See, that's what I do. And so the next day, you said, well, I've got to go get him a car. And so you put it off a few days, and so then you do go in and get a car. And you go in and probably look at it. Here's two of them. Which one will I get? You look at the back, one's $1.50 and one's $1.25. So you take $1.25. Now, I know how you got those cards. See, how do you know that? Because I've looked at the back of them, I save $0.25 and put it down. See? Now, see, that doesn't make any difference. See, I know how you got them. But do you know how I felt when I got those cards? I just lavished those cards. I just lapped them up like a dog laps up milk. I'd go to the mailbox and I'd get those cards and I'd take them home and I'd open them up and they just meant so much to me. And I read every word in there. And I know the person didn't write that. He just bought the card. Some people didn't even read the poem that's in it. I did. I read them over and over and over as I sat in my chair alone the other night. And let me tell you something else. Those people who wrote a little note on the side cannot know how much you help a grieving person. For those words over there, now nobody wrote anything that solved my problems. You can't. See, you can't say anything that solves the problems. But if you just write a little note over there and just say, I just can't imagine how much you hurt. It's more than I can comprehend. And I feel so sorry for you. I would just read that. I'd read it, and I think they care. They care. They went home, and they didn't just put a stamp on them. They cared. I knew you didn't know what to say. I knew you didn't know what to say better than you knew that you didn't know what to say. Because I've been on both ends of the situation, see? But I read it. And I set aside the cards that had little notes written on them so I could go back and read them again. You say it's childish. Call it whatever you want to. It's grieving. It's not a waste of time. I always thought it was a waste of time to send flowers. I admired those flowers. I looked at those flowers. Those flowers, the hundreds of dollars that was spent in flowers, meant so much to me. The hugs, the physical contacts, people coming in and hugging me, men and women. Words won't relieve pain, but physical contact will. So hug people. Taking in food. How many times have I taken food to people and driven 10 or 15 miles thinking how dumb it is? This little bit of food that I'm taking over there is not worth anything. And it wasn't until I saw the food on my table. And I can't tell you what that meant to me. My whole life's changed. There's not one thing that's the same about me. And now then, I know that that food really means something. The prayers, brethren met down at the church building and prayed. Attending the funeral, you can't know how much it means to look out and see a building full of friends. They're saying, I love you, respect you, admire the one that died. Those things words cannot express, and yet the comfort that is there. Now then, as she goes into the comforting, to the other stage, into the suffering stage. Now, as you get out of that shock, you say, well, what are you doing in the months to come? Well, in a recent poll back in the Midwest, they took a survey. How long do you think it takes a person to get over suffering? The average answer was 2 weeks. See, and that's the way that we act. We will expect a person to get over the funeral and in a week or so be on their road to recovery. But as we mentioned last night, in actuality it takes 2 years, and it takes 5 years to get back to normal physically and mentally again. Now this long, slow adjustment of living without someone you love is the second state of grief. It's called suffering. The suffering stage is the worst stage of all. You suffer in the shock stage too, but not as acutely because you have had the experience of living with grief. Only the prospect, no longer dreamlike, the suffering becomes a sleepless nightmare. Yet despite the agony, it's nature's way of cleansing your wound. I'm reading from these other experts, these people. It is much like the rising and the fall of the waves hitting against the shore. There's a crush of an oncoming wave and the lull as it recedes. Suffering is like that. It comes and goes in waves of pain, then recedes only to return deep and penetrating, but never constant. Now, they say, I state unequivocally, the importance of the role of friends can play during the stage of suffering is so important, so don't turn away. So now, what's it like? What's those next months like as you start going through after the funeral? Okay, you get through the funeral, and then you're ready to start looking at the world again. And as you go out the first day, you see cars going back and forth. And there they were going down to Boeing. And I just became angry. Those people don't care that I'm hurting. Those people don't care that my wife is dead. They're going to work. I want a national holiday. I want every car to stop. I was bleeding, and I needed it, and that's the way everybody feels. Nobody cares. And so you begin. And now then you're going to go through all kind of silly things. You lose your self-esteem. You just totally lose it. I felt that I had absolutely not one thing to offer to this world. Every good thing I had ever done, I had done because of her power that was behind me. Never one thing had I ever done by myself. I totally lost my self-esteem. There is a death wish that comes that is unbelievable. It's not suicidal. I never one minute thought about taking my own life. But I've never wanted to do anything as badly as I wanted to die. I prayed to God. And then I'd stop and I'd say, Lord, if it be thy will, this is what I want. But I would beg, and I wanted to, there was not one thing. Never when I was a little kid did I want ice cream or a bicycle as much as I wanted to die. The death wish is with you 24 hours a day. A total loss of self-esteem, total hopelessness. It's just a different world that you really can't believe. Every second of your waking hours, you're thinking about her. Last night, I told you, I'd tell you something kind of unusual. What happened to me is that in about 2 weeks after she died, I was driving down the road with some of my family, and a truck in front of me hit a deer and killed a deer and left it in the middle of the road. I swerved around, and there's a cliff on both sides. I look back, I mean, here comes over the mountain a long line of cars, and so I know there's going to be a wreck there. So I slam on my brakes, pull over to the side, jump out to get the deer out of the road. I jump back there, and before I can get to the deer, the semi-truck in the dark is bearing down on me. I jump out of the way of the semi, hits the deer, knocks him up about as high as my head, lands right there in the middle. I grab him and pull him off and throw him over the cliff, and hear the cars go by. Now, that took 15 seconds, maybe, of the whole thing. Just a great experience, just an unusual experience. And the first thing I did when I got him off, about 15 seconds, and threw him off, turn around, and there goes the cars, and they hit me. I wasn't thinking of her when I jumped out of the way of that semi. And it felt so good. There was a few seconds, maybe up to 10 seconds, that she was not in my mind. And I stood on that side of the road on that rainy night thinking, maybe there is hope. If I can do it 10 seconds out here in a situation like this, maybe the day will come when I can do it for 10 minutes. And you can't imagine how happy and how proud I was that I had 10 seconds of freedom. Now, after all those weeks, there was. That went on for about another, I think in about the 8th week. I was over at a family's house after services, and he and I both liked football, so we were watching it. I didn't care who won. I didn't care anything about football at all. But you have to do something. So I was sitting there, and I was watching the game, and I was thinking about her on my mind all the time. And they throw a pass, and this guy goes down, and he jumps for the ball, and the guy hits him, and he turns a flip in the air. And she turns a flip in the air, and I thought he was going to come down on his neck. I was sitting there, I was looking at it, and I came out of the chair, like that. And then I went back, and I didn't think of her then. For that period of time, she wasn't on my mind in 8 weeks. And I sat down, and I said, Lowell, there's hope. There's hope. If you can do it that long, maybe there's hope. And it is. Now then, I can go for, an hour or two, three sometimes maybe, without thinking of her. But I'm just telling you what it's like at that period of time. Absolutely, totally there. Now, another thing you do is that you idolize the dead. I began to idolize her. Everything she did was perfect. She never did one bad thing. Everything that I did depended upon her. And I totally idolized her, and I knew I couldn't do anything. So I didn't move the furniture, because if I moved a chair to vacuum, I might not get it back in exactly the same place. And there's only one place that chair fits in this room, one perfect place, and that's where she put it. If I ever move it, it'll never be back in the same place again. And you can't imagine the trauma I went through the day I vacuumed the floor for the first time. Taking the chair and pulling it over was just almost like putting a gun to her head and shooting her. And how I cried and did it, and finally rearranged the furniture so it'd never be the same again. And you idolize. And I sat there one night, and I'm idolizing, I'm reading a book, really, and what it says is, don't idolize the dead too long. And it hit me. That's what I'm doing. And I began to think, I can't idolize her. But why shouldn't I? She was perfect. Everything she did was perfect. Everything I did was imperfect. You can't fight it. And so I sat there, and here's what I thought. I thought, Lowell, surely you did one thing that's good. And I sat there and tried to think of one thing. Now, let's just think of one thing that I did and I can do without her. And I came up with two things. I always changed the oil in the car without asking her. And I would come home, and sometimes I mowed the lawn before she told me it needed to be mown. Now, if I can do those two things, and I've actually done them, then everything didn't depend on her. And that's how I started out, coming out of that idolization. And then I got to think, well, she didn't work out my sermons. I can still preach. Yeah, but the reason I could preach is because she's in the audience. She was backing me up, you know. No, I've held meetings when she wasn't there. This sounds funny. E.L. Flannery's laughing at this. but for an individual to talk this, that's how you feel, see, during this time. Your mind is on the two tracks. Let me read you what my definition of grief is. You won't get it the first time around, but maybe if you get the tapes, you will. It is an illogical state of existence ruled by emotions in a cloud of fear on a road of extremes. Every one of those phrases means something. I don't have time to do it tonight. You bounce back and forth. What am I going to do? You can't be depended on. My checkbook was $400 off the first time that it was bounced. I couldn't find it. I had to give it to my daughter. She found it. Well, here, Dad. The next month, it was $450 off. She bounced it and says, here, Dad. And do you know how long it was before my bank book bounced? 9 months before I could get my bank book to bounce. All that time, I thought I was a pretty smart guy, too. Everything changes. You just go through. Okay, real quickly. My first feelings of improvement came in the 8th week. Then in the 11th week, I have down, was the first day I spent without crying. In the 11th week, and this is interesting, was the first time I could visualize her face. I was unable to see what she looked like for 11 weeks. I couldn't visualize her. Just, what did she look like? I had no idea. I could see her body. I could not put a face on her. In the 11th week, I could. In the 12th week, I felt another improvement. In the 16th week, I wrote this. This is 4 months. Said, I feel like I've been hit in the head and knocked down. I've gotten up on my knees and now starting to stand up, but a heavy weight is on my shoulders. I feel like I fought so hard to get to this point that I'm tired. As I look to the future, it looks bleak. I don't feel like fighting any longer, and of course, if I don't, depression will set in. And now I see why most people have a relapse at this point. And it's interesting, in 4 months, people generally do have a relapse. I was looking for that, and I started, but I pulled myself out, I haven't caught it. And then in the 24th week, I write, I'm tired of hurting, just plain tired. And I have a note, I ate by myself for the first time today. The first time I sat down, went over to a restaurant, and sat down and forced myself to order something by myself. In the 27th week, I got out of bed and got in the tub before I thought of her. And that was a big day. In the 30th week, I got down, I'm just taking some highlights, as you see as you're going through. I still want to fold the towels right. Now, you say, what do you mean by that? Well, it's just silly little things. She had a set of towels with some birds on them. And I went in one day to help her fold the towels, and I folded them, and the birds didn't stick out. So when you put them out, you know that you see it. And so she said, honey, don't you know how to fold towels? Well, yeah, they're folded. Well, you fold with the birds out. So she showed me how to fold them, and I looked. And I tried. I don't know how they make towels that way, but they don't come out right. You have to turn them around. And so I folded the towels for her that day. And another time I folded the towels, too. I wasn't really a bad husband. I did it twice before she died. And after she died, I had to fold those towels with those birds out. And they had to be out. Because if somebody came and those birds weren't out, it would be a reflection upon her. And I'd fold those towels, and they'd just tear me up. But everything had to be exactly the way she did. And it was in the 30th week. I folded the towels and the birds wasn't out. And I looked at them. And I said, I'm not going to put those birds out. And it's on the bed. Yeah, I've got to put those birds out. Those birds are supposed to be out. And I'm not going to do it. And I stood there and I had an argument with myself. And in the 30th week, I won the argument and reluctantly picked it up. I don't care what she says. And I took those things in there and put those towels down and haven't folded a bird out since. But 30 weeks it took me to do that one little thing. In the 39th week, I got down here. I noticed people are more friendly to me on the streets. And it hit me. And there's a reason for that. It's because I started being more friendly to people. You see, up to this time, I was just a zombie walking around. And I got to noticing at that time, people were speaking to me on the streets, in cars, you know, and things. Now, why are people friendly all of a sudden? And then it hit me. I'm improving. I'm smiling a little bit. And at the end of a year, then you just can't imagine how things start coming together. They start coming together. The end of a year, you go through that first anniversary, and there you have hit that first thing, the first anniversary date, and you've got through it, and now then you believe that you can start living. The next 6 months, good things really start to happening then. But at this period of time, the pain just starts relieving just a little bit. But you're going through this terrible pain all during this period of time. Silly things you do. I've got so many things here. My time is already over. And I'm just going to have to try to determine here what I want to say. A lot of humorous things that I've got down here. Let me just give you one or two. One of them that I drive in and I constantly forget to turn the lights out of my car. So I go in for coffee, meet this guy. I get out of the car, start to walk in, look at my lights are on. I got to turn off the lights. So go back, I unlock the car door, reach in, lock the car door, close it, and start to walk in. Well, I didn't turn off my lights. So I go back, and this time reach in there. Now, what am I in here for? I've got it, you know, and I almost did it the third time. And I looked, oh yeah, it's the lights. And so I turned the lights off. I ran my batteries down twice and had to call people to come in the church building and get me there. One morning, I got up and took a bath, and I got out each pair of my underclothes, and I put on my undershirt, and then I put on another undershirt and went over to get my pants to... Yeah, I did that. And all this time, I thought I was normal. One time in the office, my tape ran out, my roller. I take the old tape roller out and take the spool out, you know, and go get the other tape roller. And I take it out and throw the spool away and get the other out right here. And I have to go back and start digging in there. All kind of dumb things. I've got a whole page of them, but we must move on. Okay, what do you do? Real quick, what you do is you go and you be there. Don't wait for them, because you go do it. Don't you wait. You're not never going to enjoy it. You go. When you go, you just listen, and be general. Just ask them questions and let them talk. Don't give any advice unless they ask for it, unless you're a very, very close friend. Don't condemn them when they talk foolishly. If they say, I want to die, don't say, oh, no, you don't. They're going to say a lot of stupid things. Your job is just to look and listen and be a friend. Always ask how they feel. Talk about the dead. Ask questions about them. Relate some good story about the dead. I still go in for coffee. My friend this week, we sat and we talked about Doris for about an hour this week, just about various things and what happened in there. Write a note every once in a while and just say thinking about you. Know that all of this is really, really terrible, see. And go about it really in that way. Now the last part is rejoicing with them in the recovery stage. After the first year, and as the people start recovering, now's the time of when you start pulling back. You've helped them as a parent almost all the way through. Now start pulling them back and letting them make a life for their own. And I've got down here, recovery seems to be noticed in about 6 months. Every 6 months, a noticeable difference takes place. One would think it would be easy to rejoice with them that rejoice. A friend of mine who has been through a lot of grief once told me, said, Lowell, it's easier to weep with them that weep than it is to rejoice with them that rejoice. And she was right. And that's the first time that ever hit me. And I was looking in the Bible. One time when David had lost his loved ones and he was weeping and he was crying, and some of those statements I read last night in 1 Samuel 36, the people came around and on some other things got so mad that they began and were going to stone him. At that time, he needed help. When Jesus was on the cross, that's the time that people came around and mocked him. And so, in this period of intense pain, when comfort begins to set in, an individual starts to enjoy the freedom. The comfort begins to set in, he hates his freedom, but he starts to enjoy and endure it. And being used to it, he begins to enjoy it somewhat. And this then sometimes causes jealousy within people, and certain things are going to happen. And finally, when the pain subsides and the loneliness sets in, he's ready to make contact with the opposite sex, and this will cause the bomb to explode. Widows find this to be true early in grieving because friends view them as competitors for their husbands. Men rarely have this problem until they begin to date. Men are welcome into circumstances for the first year, but widows better really watch it because other women, close friends, will start drawing back because they're afraid that widow is out after that husband. And this happens in almost every case of widow. It's a pathetic thing, but it does. Another book says, it says, you will lose friends. Said, it is not a matter of whether you will, but when you will. Now, I couldn't believe that then, but I do now. Another book said, we all know enough old cranks to be assured that someone is going to cause us trouble. And I found this to be true in every case. And I've been helping people. And as I tell them, the time's going to come when people are going to start talking about you. If you start dating, you start doing certain things. And they break down and cry. And they say, yeah, that's happened. Why does it happen? And it's going to happen in that way. And so there are going to be people that are going to fuss. They're not going to like the way you do it. They're going to want you to say, you don't do this for a period of time. You don't do this. And other people are going to demand that you go along their schedule. I don't know of any solution to that. All the surveys show that it happens to everybody. And it's a pathetic thing that it does. And so what I would say then is when this recovery starts, don't be a meddler in other men's matters. Begin to pull back and let the griever do more for himself. He must reestablish his life so he can become independent and self-sufficient. said you've almost been a parent for several months. Now do what you would do with your own children. Back off and remain friends. And so, helping them through in that realm. Let me read you a statement that I made to my last class at the end of a year, and then we'll close this sermon. That is, I made the following statement, and it's attached to that. I said, I can truly appreciate this famous drawing, and I'm not going to put it up there today. It said, I look at my life as one blessed by God. I was given 32 years with a woman that changed my life from evil to good, from darkness to light, from Satan to God. She gave me three children, who I'm proud of, who's brought me more happiness than I can express. She herself brought me a third of a century of happiness that few men have experienced. As I stated in my first class 1 year ago, I truly believe that she was given to me by the providence of a loving God. For all this, I shall ever be grateful every day of my life. She will always live in my memory, and I will always look forward to seeing her again in the life beyond this one. I even look at this tragedy of losing my mate as a blessing. It has been painful beyond words, but James says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into manifold temptations, knowing that the proving of your faith worketh patience, and let patience have its perfect works, that ye be perfect and entire, lacking in nothing. I know that I am better for having experienced this grief. I've been able to show a compassion to others who suffer in a way I could never have done before. I've been able to give advice and encouragement to others who suffer in a way I could never have done before. I have a patience for others that I could never have had before. I know that I am far from perfect, but I know that by the grace of God I am a better man. For this I thank God and count it a blessing. I look at how others have had to suffer a long, slow, prolonged death. I count it a blessing that neither Doris, my children, or myself have had to endure such hardships. For this I thank God. My list of blessings would never end if I attempted to mention them all. The final one I will mention is that I have now had the opportunity in the prime of my life to experience new things. I am learning from my life as a single man. It's unbelievable what married people do not understand and indeed cannot understand about living the single life. It is painful, but exciting to learn and experience a new kind of life. I have the opportunity of establishing a new married life. After years of experiencing marriage and studying about marriage and observing marriages, I now have that opportunity to choose a new mate if I so desire. I now understand the wisdom in Doris's words when she said, you will appreciate your new wife more than you've appreciated me, because then you will know what you have. For this I give God thanks. I have now lived through the period of the most intense pain. My second year will still have some pain, but it should bring me to the point where I'll be happy with my new life. I have prayed continually that God will guide me in my new life, that he will guide me to places he wants me to go, to the woman he wants me to marry, if indeed he does choose me to marry, the work that he wants me to do. I do look upon the future with a sense of excitement. I'm already beginning to enjoy it, and I feel that it will continue to get better and better. But the primary goal and desire of my life is that all that I say and all that I do will glorify a loving and gracious God, who has blessed me beyond measure. To those who are now suffering, and to those who will soon be suffering, may I close this series of classes by saying to you, for the past year, I have been walking in the valley of the shadow of death, and it's been a painful experience. But today, 1 year later, I can say to you that I now see the light at the end of the valley of the shadow of death, and indeed, it's a bright light. I can now say that I have almost walked through the valley of the shadow of death. And if I can do it, you also can do it, and we both can say with David, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. I've gone over time tonight. I apologize to you for it. Tomorrow night will not be so long. It'll be a normal lesson. Should there be one in our audience tonight that needs to be cleansed in the blood of Jesus Christ, we'll ask our song leader to limit the singing tonight since we've gone over to only the first stanza of this song. Would you respond if you need to while we sing and while we sing that first stanza?